From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton. In a state of the state...
All members vote who desire to vote.
Members, this budget is not our preference.
Share the pain.
We got to stop the game.
No baloney.
Taxes, taxes, taxes.
The next step's the governor's.
Only the good Lord knows.
Mr. Secretary, call the roll.
In his State of the State speech yesterday, Governor Jerry Brown laid out his priorities on a variety of issues for his second year in office. To discuss them, as well as other issues from around the Capitol, is our own Ben Adler. Ben, welcome to Insight.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. So what happened yesterday? Or Tuesday?
Well, no, it is yesterday.
It was just yesterday.
There was a, what do we call it, a State of the State address. The annual speech, of course, from the governor to a joint convention of the state legislature. And I think what a lot of people were struck by is the contrast between his speech from last year when he first took office with a $26 billion budget deficit and this year when, in his mind, the deficit, and not just his mind, is sharply reduced. People would quarrel over just how far reduced it is, whether it's about a half or two-thirds or I believe he said a three-quarters reduced, but mm-hmm. it is down. So let's start. I thought we could start today by listening to a brief clip of the governor from his 2011 State of the State address.
California faces a crisis that is real and unprecedented. Each of us will have to struggle with our conscience and our constituencies as we hammer out a sensible plan to put our state on a sound fiscal footing, honestly balance our budget, and position California to regain its historic momentum.
And now let's listen to him from this year.
Contrary to those declinists who sing of Texas and bemoan our woes, California is still the land of dreams as well as the Dream Act. And thank you for saying that.
Much more optimistic speech, and he called people who weren't more optimistic declinists.
Yeah, exactly. The change, I think, very different from previous years. And I think, for one thing, the governor wanted to be able to say, look, there's been progress in my first year, given that he didn't have a budget deal as he had hoped for. He did not have new taxes last year as he had hoped for and is now going to try for again this year. So that, I think, is certainly in part what led to the governor taking a more optimistic tone. But also, you know, the governor may view it as his responsibility as the chief executive of the state to talk his state up in much the way that, you know, if you want to make the Texas comparison, Rick Perry is always out there talking his state up. And, you know, just governors from all states do that. The president, in theory, does that about the United States as well.
And there's also a little bit, you know, there's a little bit of taking credit there, isn't there, for actually, and he spread it around for getting things into a somewhat better situation.
Well, you know, you ask a Republican, you're probably gonna be not so, you know, you're not always gonna get an agreement on that. It as with many things, it kind of depends on who you ask. But yeah, the budget down, you know, to either a $9.2 billion deficit if you ask the governor's Department of Finance, or about a $13 billion deficit if you ask the Legislative Analyst Office, and that's for the 18-month period starting now and ending at the end of the next fiscal year, halfway through 2013. If you look at part of that deficit is just the carryover in the current year's budget, and then you have about $5 billion or so, according to the governor, of next year's deficit. So no matter how you look at it, the deficit is less. Republicans are going to say you don't need taxes for that. You just have to let the economy continue to bounce back as it did during this year. And as Republicans like Bob Huff point out, revenue did go up over the last year. And mm-hmm. that was something that Bob Huff was kind of talking about after he is the Senate Minority Leader. And when I caught up with him after the State of the State address, that was part of his point.
He made a couple of statements we'd agree with. We can't spend more than we have. We should bring spending in line with our revenues. Those are right out of the Republican playbook. But then he goes right back to the Democrat playbook of the only way we can get these revenues is to raise taxes. And, of course, his solution is to go raise taxes on the rich and then a sales tax. And we just believe that's fundamentally wrong. Last year, we were told we had to pass the taxes or the state was going to go off the cliff. Lo and behold, we had $8.4 billion of unanticipated revenue. The economy is coming back, and they were able to balance the budget without raising taxes. This year, Our problem, as he said, the structural deficit is one-fourth what it was last year. So why in the world would anybody, even if they wanted to give the governor more taxes, give him 5 years at $35 billion? All that will do is create a recipe for growing government, unsustainable government, because we're having a problem sustaining what we have already.
Ben, it sounds like there's not a whole lot of movement on the Republican side in terms of taxes, and that, of course, is one of the governor's main initiatives this year, is to do a tax increase.
Yeah, and there probably isn't much that will change that dynamic, in particular because the governor is not searching for Republican votes on his tax measure in the legislature. Mm-hmm. So given that Republicans, many of them will eventually face primary challenges either for their own jobs or for their next jobs, there is no, in their mind, motivation to voting for taxes. In fact, they won't even have to. They won't even have to take that particular vote this year. And they're not, you know, on the other hand, there won't necessarily be the other parts of a deal, pension reform, regulatory reform, a spending cap. The governor is pushing pensions, pushing his 12-point pension proposal, and he's running into some reluctance from Democrats on that. Republicans mm-hmm. are generally behind it, but, you know, it's not going to be an issue of a horse trading vote like the governor was hoping for last year. So, no, I don't think you should expect to see a change in the Republicans' tone towards taxes at the state capitol. But that doesn't mean Democrats aren't going to keep talking about it. And here is what Assembly Speaker John Perez had to say after yesterday's speech.
My colleagues on the Republican side who issued their response to the State of the Union address before it was even written were lucky. They weren't burdened by the facts. They had a pat answer of no, and it's the same pat answer of no that they've used consistently. Last year, neither of them engaged substantively in the discussions around what solutions we would undertake. They were critical about the solutions we undertook. It flies in the face of the fact that we closed 75% of our structural deficit in 1 year. So we hope that they will take the opportunity to reflect on what the governor's State of the State outlined as an opportunity for investment and growth for California, and decide to finally become serious partners in finding solutions for our state.
Ben, the governor really is in between not just the Republicans but the Democrats also. I mean, the pension is a big problem, but also the Legislative Analyst Office came out last week and said that this plan to raise taxes isn't necessarily the most sustainable way to do it either. And the notion that we're sort of going to grow out of this still seems rather far fetched, doesn't it?
What you have is a situation where, as I think Dan Walters, the Sacramento Bee columnist, touched on in last week's Capital Chat, the situation is that the revenues, when you rely on a lot of income tax revenue from the wealthiest Californians, that revenue goes up and down. It's pretty volatile depending on the stock market, depending on the economy. And so during a recession, there's a lot less of that money coming in, but it's responsible for such a greater proportion of the budget and of the state's overall cash picture, that it has a disproportionate effect on the budget. So that was the point of the nonpartisan legislative analyst. Now, there are some areas where the governor is kind of, not on the same page as some of his legislative Democrats, and of course, plenty of areas where he's not on the same page as Republicans. Let's talk about the Democrats a bit, because we've been talking about the Republicans. I've got a quick little couple of sound bites here that I'd like to play on my end real quick of a couple of Democrats after yesterday's speech. And the governor said about his 12-point pension proposal, examine it, improve it, but please take up the issue and do something real. And lawmakers like Assemblyman Bill Monning and Senator Ted Lieu say that while they do believe California needs some pension reform, they're not ready to back Brown's plan as it is.
It's subject to our continued negotiations.
He said, take my plan and make it better. And I believe that's what the legislature is going to do.
It's subject to our continued negotiation.
You know, that actually started looping. Sorry about that. But in any event, then you have the governor, or not the governor, the governor's budget proposing $1 billion in cuts to CalWORKs, the state's welfare program. And a lot of Democrats are very reluctant on that, too. Here is what Senator Mark Leno had to say. You've got that clip over on your end. Here's what Senator Mark Leno, the chair of the Senate Budget Committee, had to say about what the governor wasn't really talking about during his State of the State address yesterday.
Conspicuous by its absence in his comments was anything to do with the social safety net, which, of course, is in his sights as cuts that yet need to be made. And that's very difficult for all of us who care about those who are hurting the most, because we have devastated social service and health programs in recent years. And the thought that we would cut another $1.5 billion from them is really a very bitter pill to swallow.
That's Mark Leno from San Francisco. I'm speaking with Ben Adler about the reaction to the State of the State speech yesterday, Governor Brown's speech. Ben, so that was one response from a Democrat. The big issue that he talked about quite a bit in the speech was education, and a lot of what he's proposing in terms of his taxes and things like that, if it doesn't go through, it's been said that he's holding education hostage. How is that playing on the Democratic side?
Well, there's a couple of points that you raised there. The talk about education in yesterday's State of the State address dealt largely not necessarily with the funding, though he did talk about the importance of funding education and that would have a lot to do with whether the initiative passes or not in November. But he talked about demanding continuous improvement in meeting the state standards, but at the same time not imposing excessive or detailed state mandates. And he also talked about requiring fewer hours of standardized testing. In other words, letting schools have a little bit more, or perhaps a lot more, local control. That's an aspect that did draw praise from Republicans. I think Assembly Member Connie Conway, the Assembly Minority Leader, praised that. And I've heard a couple others speak well of that. But then your issue of the school funding and the initiative, another Assembly member, a Republican, Dan Logue, used the word blackmail. And I've heard pundits and others use, you know, hostage or ransom note, phrases like that, as far as, you know, as far as that goes. I'm guessing that you're going to have Democrats who disagree with pretty strongly with those terms. So it does depend on who you ask. Is it responsible for the governor to go ahead and say, if the tax doesn't pass, the funding's got to come from somewhere. The cuts have to come from somewhere. Education is the vast majority of government spending in Sacramento, and so you can't have $5 billion fewer dollars in the budget and not cut education. You know, so that's what he's saying. On the other hand, Republicans are saying, look, this is not necessarily how we would do it.
And one other thing that he spent quite a bit of time in the speech that I was struck by was he talked quite a bit about high-speed rail. Was that seen as something that was sort of feeding into the optimism and we're moving forward and we're still doing positive things? How was that received among people that you spoke with?
Well, Democrats are a little bit split on high-speed rail. Republicans are certainly united in opposition. But it is true that the governor put forth a very strong statement in favor of the legislature voting to approve issuing a couple $1 billion in bonds towards high-speed rail, a very embattled project lately that has come under fire for its ridership estimates, for its increasing costs, so on and so forth. Democrats are, you know, you talk to them, you'll get a lot who say, I want high-speed rail, I believe in high-speed rail. I don't believe that the current business plan from the High Speed Rail Authority is necessarily the way to go. That business plan calls for starting in the Central Valley. And a lot of Democrats say you need to at least start where the population centers are, either the Bay Area or Los Angeles. There will be a new business plan coming out from the High Speed Rail. They'll actually revise the one they issued a few months ago. And that's coming out in a couple of weeks. It's going to have new leadership. The Rail Authority will as well. Governor Jerry Brown kind of orchestrating the exit of the CEO and the chairman of the board, who will not leave the board entirely, but will leave the chairmanship and will be replaced by a board member who was appointed by Governor Brown himself. So the governor is very clearly taking ownership of building high-speed rail. And he's saying, let's do it now. Let's do it this year. California needs to dream big. And he talked about projects like BART in the Bay Area that he says had their skeptics at the time, turned out very differently, he says, and where would we be today if we had listened to the skeptics? And he's applying that argument to high-speed rail. And frankly, I hate to use an old news cliche, but only time is going to tell who is right about high-speed rail.
Well, and it was funny when he mentioned that. He talked about BART and that it was objected to because somebody said it was going to be $1 billion wasted. And at this point, that doesn't seem like very much money.
High-speed rail cost is about $100 billion as it's projected at the moment.
Yes. All right. Well, Ben Adler in our Capital Bureau, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, education expert Diane Ravitch. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. I'll be speaking with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Bill Champlin later in today's show. Champlin sang in the band Sons of Champlin and Chicago. He also played keyboard, organ, and guitar. If you have a favorite song of Bill's, I may be able to ask him about it. And you can tell us your favorite Chicago or Sons of Champlin song by going to our Facebook page, Insight on Capital Public Radio, or you can send an email to insight@capradio.org. Diane Ravitch is an expert on education who's written more than a dozen influential books on the subject, and she'll be speaking in Sacramento at the Community Center Theater tomorrow night. I spoke with Diane Ravitch yesterday morning, just after Governor Brown's State of the State address, in which he spent a good deal of time discussing education issues. And I asked Ravitch about Brown's comment that education in California is a house divided.
Well, yes, indeed, it is divided. There is this group that calls itself the Reform Movement, and they seem to have taken aim at public education, at teachers, at principals, at everybody who works in a public school. And there is this division between the people who actually do the work and the people who are advancing reforms that have been untried and that are going to certainly have negative consequences for kids and for teachers and principals.
Yes, he referred to ideas from experts and academics that are usually labeled reform and regularly change at 10-year intervals.
Well, I hope they're changed at 10-year intervals because we're right in the middle of one of these reform movements that's particularly pernicious for what's happening in our schools.
And that's based on your most recent book was the Death and Life of American Schools, and talking about testing.
Well, yes, testing, and also this movement towards privatization, which I'm very concerned about because it is basically, as I see it, the traditional right-wing agenda, which is to remove professionalism from teaching so that teachers will be at-will employees, to turn parents into consumers, and to emphasize testing, testing, testing.
And why isn't that working?
It's not working because all of the reformers' strategies, like merit pay and paying teachers by test scores, they all rely on the standardized test. And the more you emphasize standardized testing and make it the most important thing in schools, the more you lose real education. In a school that gets high scores, unless it happens to be in an affluent suburb, which we have plenty of, but in inner-city schools and urban schools and even a lot of suburban schools, the more you say to teachers, your job depends on getting high test scores, they will teach to the test, they will practice test, they will have devote weeks and weeks of practicing for the state test, and then we find that the only thing that kids are really prepared for are tests of basic skills, reading and math, and the schools lose the arts, they lose activities, field trips, they lose science, they lose history, they lose geography. And at a certain point, you have to turn around and say, hey, guys, this is not education. This is not good education. It's bad education.
And in fact, the governor suggested in his speech that he said, I believe it is time to reduce the number of tests. Part of the problem with the tests, though, is that they're nationally imposed tests. Is that correct? Is that part of No Child?
Well, part of the problem is, first of all, that they have accountability attached to them, and that's high stakes. And so, as I was saying before, the more you make them high stakes, the more you make them attached to rewards and punishments, the more important they become, the more they start dominating the curriculum and ruining it. And this, right now, the whole testing regime is imposed by Washington. It's not the way most states would want their testing to take place. It's not the way most educators would want to be judged or evaluated. So, yeah, this is externally imposed, and, I salute Governor Brown. I think he's the only governor who's doing any original thinking about education.
And originally this was part of No Child Left Behind, and it was sort of sold in the beginning of last decade as sort of the hope that was going to save schools and make schools more accountable. And you were involved with that to a degree, were you not yourself?
Well, I wasn't involved in drafting it, but I supported it. And, you know, I have to say that a few years ago I realized I was wrong. Unfortunately, a lot of the people who supported it, I think, haven't given it a second thought. The original idea was not that it would make schools accountable, but that it was going to save poor children. That's why it's called No Child Left Behind. Mm-hmm. The idea was we would eliminate inequality. There would be no child left behind. All children would get high test scores because the more we test, the more their scores would go up. And we'd see the achievement gap would close and the scores would go up and the graduation rates would, all these great things would happen just by testing. And, you know, I look back and I wonder, why did we believe that? Why did I believe that? It was, what a stupid idea. I mean, the nature of standardized tests is that they're always going to be 50% of the kids at the bottom.
Because of the bell curve?
It's a bell curve. By nature, its standardized tests are normed and they're bell curved. But we have not seen any substantial reduction in the achievement gap since the 1970s and early 1980s. That's when we made real progress closing the gap. Because of economic changes, because of job opportunities, because of early childhood education and federal programs like Title I that sent money to poor schools. But this decade of No Child Left Behind has not been a successful decade at all. It's been a decade of stagnation.
I'm speaking with Diane Ravitch. She is an education expert and author of many, many books, and she'll be speaking here in Sacramento this weekend. Also, Governor Brown also at the beginning mentioned how many students, he said, 6 million students, 300,000 teachers, and that some humility was called for.
Well, that's a great idea. I think that what Governor Brown represents is wisdom. And there are a lot of governors all over the country rushing to impose more testing, more punishments, more closing schools, and they have no humility. They think that they know how to reform schools, and they haven't given it very much thought. All they can think about is carrots and sticks. And I think what Governor Brown is saying is, no, professionals are not donkeys. They don't need carrots and sticks. And we have to approach education with some understanding of what a complicated business this is, educating children, and how it involves not just teachers, but it involves parents, it involves district leadership, curriculum, and some fundamental understanding of what do we want to achieve by educating kids, not just high test scores. We want education. We want people who have the wisdom to become good citizens, to keep our democracy going into the next generation.
Now, No Child Left Behind, and a lot of these reforms were initially proposed, and as you said, you were on board to a degree with some of them. As a response to declining education, it doesn't seem to have helped very much. What do you think is the solution at this point?
Well, first of all, I don't think we have declining education. I challenge that characterization. This has become the reformers' mantra. And, you know, these reformers, I call them corporate reformers. They have corporate-style approach, and they try to create a sense of crisis. They want the whole country to be like New Orleans, to be wiped out by, to have the whole school system wiped out by a hurricane so that they can privatize everything. We don't have a declining school system. We have been talking, I'm a historian of education, we have been talking about the crisis in our schools for about 100 years, and our society has gotten stronger, our economy has gotten stronger, and we're still complaining about our schools. These corporate guys look back to 50 years ago and they said, oh, the schools were wonderful then. Well, I can tell you that 50 years ago, people were complaining about the schools then. It's like a parlor game in the U.S. Mm-hmm. to say the schools are declining and the youth is going, you know, down the tubes, and it was better when I was a child.
Uh-huh.
I mean, 50 years ago, our schools were racially segregated. They had no obligation to educate kids with disabilities, and we didn't have very many kids who didn't speak English. So we have huge challenges in our society. And frankly, the biggest source of low academic scores and low academic performance is poverty, and we don't even talk about that. Instead, we're talking about teacher evaluation, when what we should be talking about is the scandalous level of child poverty. More than 20% of our kids live in poverty, and that number's going up.
And is that because alleviating poverty would, what's the connection there?
Well, the connection is this, that if you look at any standardized test in the country, whether it's the ACT or the SAT or the federal test or any test, they will show that the highest scores are the kids who come from the most affluent neighborhoods, and the lowest scores are the kids who come from the poorest neighborhoods. If we could reduce poverty, we would see many more kids succeeding in school because they would be healthier, they would come to school more often, they would pay attention more. There, many of the problems that interfere with children's learning are not learning are not something caused by their teacher. They're something caused by the fact that they haven't been well fed and they're in ill health. So poverty is a huge disadvantage that handicaps kids.
I'm speaking with Diane Ravitch about education and the history of education in this country and where we're going next. One thing that Governor Brown mentioned in his speech was he said he wants to give more authority to local school districts. It's funny, I feel like things are sort of upside down, because generally speaking, you referred to this as coming from the right, a lot of these, but usually the right is more focused on local and the left is more focused on sort of national standards, but we seem to have that completely flipped upside down this time.
Well, I think what's happened is that we have this very powerful corporate reform movement, which is funded largely by big foundations like the Gates Foundation, the Walton Family Foundation, which is probably the most conservative foundation in the country, and the Eli Broad Foundation from Los Angeles. They're all funding the same things, which is charter schools. And now you have governors like the very right-wing governor of Louisiana just announced a voucher plan for the whole state, where almost 90% of the kids will be eligible for vouchers under the Jindal plan. And then you have the state of Indiana, another right-wing governor, vouchers for the whole state. Wisconsin, Scott Walker, vouchers have been expanded. Pennsylvania and Florida, Tea Party governors, they want more vouchers. So, yeah, you know, there's right now the right is on the rise, and there's kind of a merger with the charter and voucher people all saying we've got to public education doesn't work. But there's no great country in the world that doesn't have a great public education system. This is crazy.
Now, in some way, it would seem that vouchers and giving people choice in their education is returning control to people on a local level and is returning control back to individuals to make those kind of choices. Why doesn't that work for you?
Well, it doesn't work because it's an attack on the public sector. And to privatize the public sector has always been the right-wing game plan. We've been privatizing hospitals and privatizing prisons and privatizing libraries. And this attack on the public sector is not good for democracy. I think that democracy, where people actually have a say at the ballot box about who leads their local government, who leads their state government, who leads their nation, is critical. And I think that the more we privatize and leave it to individuals, the less we will see of any sense of we are a community. I mean, the nature of democracy must be that we take care of one another. We cannot break down into it's all about me and my child, and I'm pulling out and I'm going to get a voucher. It's all about me and I don't have any responsibility for you. That really strikes at the very fabric of our democratic society.
And how do you think it strikes at the quality of education?
Well, I think that the direction we're heading in now is that everything is going to be based on test scores, and that schools are being closed based on test scores. Teachers will be fired based on test scores. That will diminish the quality of education because it will lead to schools focusing so narrowly on these rather flawed instruments, these standardized tests, that nothing else will matter. And if we start testing everything, if we begin to develop tests for physical education, tests for the arts, tests for history, all the teachers will do all day is give tests and prepare kids for tests. That's not good education.
All right. Well, Diane Ravitch, thanks for joining me.
Well, I look forward to being in Sacramento. I'm speaking in Sacramento at the Convention Center Friday night.
And that was Diane Ravitch, and she will be here tomorrow night. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, singer Bill Champlin. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Now it's time to find out what's happening in the newsroom with our senior editor, Alan Ray. What's going on, Alan?
Good morning, David. The Republican presidential winnowing continues. Herman Cain, Michelle Bachmann, John Huntsman, now Rick Perry out. Newt Gingrich's second wife is talking. Mitt Romney's offshore millions are making questions. And now we find out that Mr. Romney actually didn't win in Iowa. You'd think there would be great huzzas at this point in the White House, but probably not so much. New survey by CBS and the New York Times finds President Obama losing a lot of ground fast among the independent voters who were so critical to his election in 2008. We've been promising this or threatening it for days, and now the National Weather Service says it will rain on your afternoon drive home. If you're keeping track, it hasn't rained in Sacramento in more than a month. This new weather system is expected to leave about an inch of rain before it moves out over the weekend officially, but that's just the main weather system. The forecast actually calls for showers around the Sacramento Valley at least through Tuesday. Those stories and much more coming up on All Things Considered beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on Capital Public Radio.
Thanks, Alan, and thanks for the good news on the rain.
Well, yeah, boy, don't we need it.
Yeah, it seems like longer than a month.
Yeah, I know. But on the other hand, once it's rained for a day, when is this going away?
Right, exactly.
All right, take care.
Thanks. Bill Champlin is not exactly a household name, but he has been a nationally known musician for more than 40 years, first as a band leader during San Francisco's Summer of Love and into the 70s, and then through 28 years as a member of Hitmakers Chicago. Now he's a solo artist, and he's going to be playing at Harlow's on Saturday night, and we have him on Insight right now. Welcome to Insight, Bill Champlin.
Hey, David. How you doing, buddy?
Very well. It's great to talk to you.
So you guys are about ready to get start swimming again.
Yeah, well, hopefully it won't come to that. But having to water the lawn in January will be nice.
Yeah, tell me about it. I lived in Nashville for like 5 or 6 years, so I got a lot of friends back there. And in L.A., for the last maybe week and a half, it's been like summertime. It's actually been warmer than the summer we had. I've just loved just calling people and rubbing it in because they're they're underneath, they're in the snow and the whole nine yards. It's like, hey, well, come on out and visit, you know.
Well, I wanted to go all the way back. I mentioned, you know, you've been doing this for a very long time, and I think a lot of people don't really realize the Sons of Champlin was a San Francisco group, and the first album came out. It was a little later than the Summer of Love. It was 68, right? But the band formed in 65, and you guys were right there through the whole thing.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's what most people seem to think. We were one of the few bands in that area that, you know, and during that period of time that really didn't start off as a skittle band or that much into the folk scene and stuff like that. Whereas most of the San Francisco bands kind of were. You know, if you look at the Dead and the Airplane and even Quicksilver and stuff like that, there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on. And we kind of came out of the whole James Brown groove. You know what I mean? We were listening to a little more R&B oriented kind of stuff. So it was kind of a little different thing. It was kind of had a hard time breaking through sometimes, you know.
And did you, were you knew all those people, though, I assume, and you played a lot of the same bills and things like that, and they probably actually liked that music as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's one thing that you got to hang. I mean, people can say what they wanted about Bill Graham, but in the early days of the Fillmore and Fillmore West and everything, his putting together of different kind of acts was awesome. And I remember doing one where it was Grateful Dead, us, Sons of Champlin, and the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. You know, I mean, it was like, whoa, now there's an eclectic move. And I think I actually one time went and saw Jefferson Airplane, and they were awesome. And then, and they were second line by Charles Lloyd Quintet. It was like, now here's a real stretch of different kinds of music. So, and that's one of the things I think that Bill did that was really cool, that he kind of, people saw a lot of different kinds of music.
Well, let's listen to just a little bit of one of those signature songs from that time. This is Freedom.
Ah.
You can definitely hear. You can definitely hear. There's some James Brown happening there.
Well, kind of. You know, I mean that we shot for it. I don't know that we actually hit the bullseye, but we're aiming at it.
We had that driving thing.
But over the years we started, you know, as we changed personnel a little bit, we started landing a little more inside where R&B was. What I kind of flashed earlier on was that. If in those days you listen to Bob Dylan and even the Beatles and stuff like that, there were really good lyrics talking about real things, very real things. But it was always kind of not the greatest, you know, not the kind of music that I like. And what I kind of wanted to do was say, well, let's take this Wilson Pickett thing that we're doing and, you know, get rid of the I'm a man and a half baby stuff and put some real lyrics on it. So we, you know, I mean, all of that was, you know, all that's fine. And there's kind of a traditional R&B sort of simplicity that's kind of cool. There's something, there's a, you know, it's an art form in itself, but I kind of wanted to try to break it out, you know, kind of, you know, put the two together. So it was a bit of a cross. We're shooting for a crossover at some level. Like, let's say something real, but let's say it with this music, you know?
Well, and somebody else who actually did that, who was also from San Francisco and ended up having a huge number of hits, was Sly and the Family Stone.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we worked dates with them earlier on. I mean, I love those guys from the first album.
Well, and we should also say that the Sons of Champlin are still together in probably slightly altered form.
Actually, they aren't. I've kind of shut it down over about the last year. We had a little too big a band to be able to really even afford to play. So
right.
We're
but
not.
You had a tour this. You had a tour planned this time of year, didn't you?
No, not for the Sons.
Oh, okay. I thought I saw that
on
the website.
I'm doing with this on this Harlow's thing is, somebody, a lot of times when I'll be rehearsing just to be singing, you know, to sing with the band and stuff like that, I'll just go to the piano and you know, knock off the song and just to, you know, kind of rehearse it, see if I can remember the piano parts and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody actually said, you know, this kind of sounds good just by yourself. And a friend of mine, my manager, John Toomey, he said, you know, every once in a while Jackson Browne goes out. You know, sometimes he goes out with his band. He says, they're awesome. It's a great band. He said, but, I've seen the band enough times to know that's cool, and I don't even go to those shows. But when he goes out by himself, I go every time. So it's kind of an interesting approach. It's just to listen to the singer when I was in Nashville, I mean, I did a couple of these things. There's a place called Bluebird Cafe where writers would go.
Right.
And you'll get maybe three or four people kind of and they call them writer's rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll just take a piano or a guitar or whatever it is, and they'll pass the songs back and forth. You know, the one guy would sing his tune that maybe Keith Urban made a hit of, and you'd hear the writer sing it and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to where I was kind of really enjoying hearing these songs without having to hear them through the drummer and the horn section and the, you know, string section and the, you know, background singers and all the rest of it. And you're just hearing just a basic piano or a basic guitar and the song. And it's kind of a real interesting thing. So I kind of went, you know, I'm going to give this a shot, see if anybody's interested in it. So that's what this thing is at Harlow's. For me, it's a new thing. I was never one of those kind of guys that did that all that often. But after doing it in Nashville a few times, it was like, hey, now this is actually kind of cool.
Well, and you've got some of those songs. I mean, you wrote After the Love is Gone by Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
Turn Your Love Around by George Benson. And
yeah.
I'm not sure if you actually wrote this, but Hard Habit to Break by Chicago was one of your big vocals. Did you write that?
No, I didn't write it.
Okay.
That was written by Steve Kipner, who's an awesome songwriter.
Okay, well, let's just listen to a little bit of that to jog people's memories.
Yeah.
Had a particular sound, didn't it? Bill?
Production, and you know, David's a monster. I was almost a partner with David for years. I mean, when I left the Sons in 1977 and moved to LA and got into recording.
Uh-huh.
Just into the recording scene, you know, because there were so many records being made. I just said, I got to have a piece of this. So I ended up going down. I'd already made friends with David because he had done strings on a Sons album.
Okay. And you're talking about David Foster. We lost you for a second there, but you're talking about the producer, David Foster, right?
Yeah. And this was really early on in his production. And then he did my first two solo albums, mm-hmm. Produced those, and then I got that gig with Chicago, and they said, hey, do you think Foster would be a good producer? I said, absolutely. And that's by the time we got around to Hard Habit to Break, it was the second album he'd done, and he's awesome musician, awesome producer.
And Chicago must have been a blast for you, because you were with Chicago for 28 years, and in some ways Chicago, despite the track we just played, which is a very big ballad, Chicago was a horn band and had a lot of those same roots that you must have.
Well, at some level, yeah. I mean, earlier on, they were pretty much of a horn band. When Foster was involved in it, the horns were in it on some stuff, but I think most of the hits that he did really didn't, they weren't really so much horn-oriented. David really just made his record, which is just, and what David's records usually are is really, really well-written songs, really, really well-produced and well-sung.
And lots of synthesizers.
Yeah, well, at the time, at least, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's funny, around that period of time, I was doing a lot of vocal dates around town. I was working for Donna Summer, and Donna said, you know, Bill, you might be the best-known unknown singer in the world.
It's true. It's true. Well, hey, before we're running a little short on time, but I wanted to play just a tiny little bit of your most recent track that just came out. This is Time Step Up.
Somebody else will be there. Now I see how life is changing. I find myself learning, turning around to the people who have much less than I.
And that's Bill Champlin with his most recent recording. He's going to be performing at Harlow's on Saturday night. Just tell us real quickly a little bit about that track.
Where did you find that?
Man, oh, you know, where do you find anything? The internet, right?
Well, you know, that piece was actually written especially for there was a TV show or a radio show or an internet, you know, and I think it was starting off as a TV show. I don't know whether it is, in Minneapolis, and what it was what is the word for it? It's like a charity about charities. It's, you know, like kind of trying to teach people to get involved in whatever charity they were. And so I wrote that song for that as a theme for that show. And that's where that thing came from. I thought it was just a local thing. I didn't realize it was going to get heard anywhere. But that's cool. I mean, I did a good job on it. But
all right. Well, yeah. Bill Champlin, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. And hey, everybody out there, come on out to Harlow's. It's really going to be kind of a cool thing.
Yeah. All right. Saturday night. And you're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, sound advice with Devin Yamanaka. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Every week we feature some new releases as chosen by members of the Capital Public Radio staff. And today we've got jazz announcer Devin Yamanaka, who has a selection of new jazz releases. Welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
What you got?
First, let's hear pianist Alan Pasqua, and he has an album called Twin Bill, Two Piano Music of Bill Evans. We're going to hear Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Now, you're not going to tell me that Bill Evans wrote Take Me Out to the Ball Game, are you? I know he's a big composer, but
He did not. I don't believe he did, no, but Alan Pasqua on this album, it's kind of a double theme for this album. One of his favorite things is baseball, and then the other one is Bill Evans, so he thought, combine the two and then make it a double piano album, and you got yourself a good time. But he plays a lot of these tunes in the style of Bill Evans, that real, very tasteful, delicate, almost spare sort of way.
And,
it's funny because that song is usually so raucous. You know, you hear like a big band playing or lots of crowd noise in the background, popcorn flying everywhere or something. And there it's a guy in a studio with a piano.
And a lot of swing.
A lot of swing to make up for that raucousness.
Yeah. And what else?
We got a jazz flutist named Nicole Mitchell. This is a groovy little tune called Curly Top.
Also, a fairly traditional sound, but not you don't hear flautists quite that often.
That's true, and it's I have to full disclosure. I'm a flute player, so I have a little bit of a bias towards flutists. And I did try to play jazz flute in many moons ago, and that didn't work out very well. But the neat thing about Nicole Mitchell is that flute is her primary instrument. Usually, when you're in jazz, there are a few primary flute players who play flute only or play flute mainly. But a lot of the time, when you hear flute, it's because someone wanted to double, or you know, they play saxophone, but they want to play flute instead on this one track.
Like a Joe Farrell, right? Or Claude Bowling, maybe, but he's not exactly jazz.
I was thinking, I was thinking more along the lines of Rahsaan Roland Kirk was the first guy who I heard who was a saxophone, and then all of a sudden I heard him playing flute, and I thought, what's up with that?
Right.
That's usually what happens. Nicole Mitchell is primarily a flute player and a composer, actually. She spent a lot of time writing Suites of Music. She wrote one for Michelle Obama. And so this is her first album in kind of a while that focuses on just the straight small group, jazz groove kind of thing.
All right.
And the album's called Awakening.
And the next one's a very familiar name, Pat Martino.
Yeah, his story is absolutely incredible. 40 years in jazz, 23 albums, that ain't bad on its own. In 1980, he had a brain aneurysm, which was very, he survived it, and that's a feat unto itself. Unfortunately, the doctors, when they went in and operated on him, part of his brain they had to operate on, it kind of wiped out his memory. So he woke up and he didn't know how to play guitar anymore.
He had to learn how to play guitar all over again.
He had to take a break and relearn how to play guitar. And I can't imagine not only relearning how to play guitar, but also the psychological anguish he must have gone through. He listening to recordings of himself playing guitar and thinking, now why can't I do that? But he came back and you know, stronger and better than ever.
And how many albums has he made since then, roughly?
Oh gosh, I don't know how many since then. I only know his grand total. Okay. But certainly, I mean, I was just, when Gary Vercelli told me that story, my jaw was on the floor, because you never would know that there was any kind of hiccup in his career.
Well, let's listen to how well he learned his guitar playing. That's a Pat Martino Quartet with the amazing Jeff Tane Watts on drums.
Yes.
And that's Eric Alexander playing sax as well. So he's really matching him all the way through. It's a little hard to pick out his playing, but you can hear it in there. It's so fine.
Oh, yeah. And it being a live album, they just let it roll. And it's a lot of the tracks you can just hear him. You'd never know. He's an incredible inspiration. And he actually has a memoir out now called, I think it's called Here and Now.
And you have one more. This is Greg Reitan.
Mm-hmm.
And what's his story?
He is actually, he's a pianist. I'm kind of displaying my biases on this segment for jazz flutists and then for pianists also. But he's a pianist. This is another trio record. He's done a few trio records and really made a good name for himself. We're going to hear a tune called Great Pumpkin Waltz. It's by Vince Guaraldi originally.
That is Greg Reitan playing the Great Pumpkin Waltz. So I'm speaking with Devin Yamanaka, who's a jazz announcer here at KXJZ. Fantastic playing.
Really tasteful. Really, the thing that struck me about him, he also works in soundtracks, a lot of soundtrack composing in his background and currently. And his playing, you could hear that kind of soundtrack feel where it's not right out in front being really flashy and really aggressive. It's in the background. You notice it. You appreciate it. And it's sort of unassuming and very humble, his style is. Mm-hmm. So I love that about him. And he's done a couple other trio records that we've played on Excellence in Jazz.
All right. Well, and recapping our sound advice today, we had Pat Martino Quartet, fantastic. Mm-hmm. Greg Reitan, Nicole Mitchell,
mm-hmm.
and Alan Pasqua.
Yep, twin bill.
And Devin Yamanaka, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me back.
And that's Insight for today. I'm David Watts Barton. Tomorrow, instead of Insight, we will be broadcasting a special called America Abroad, which is about America's role in the world after U.S. forces leave Iraq and eventually Afghanistan. Insight's assistant producers are James Morrison and Lynn Weaver. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our theme music was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley, and Insight's executive director, producer is Joe Barr. Thank you for joining us.